This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2009 podcast series. Today we're speaking with Dr. Jason McLaughlin regarding suicide assessment and treatment. Jason McLaughlin is currently a professor at Kent State University in the Counseling and Human Development Services Program. He is an experienced clinician with many years of experience treating suicidal clients and their families. He is also an experienced hostage negotiator and the author of a book, Developing Clinical Skills in Suicide Assessment, Prevention, and Treatment. Dr. Jason McLaughlin, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much.
Good. Okay. To start things off, I want to say that two of our members have had clients commit suicide in the past year. Also with the Fannie Mae CEO suicide and the two recent suicides of 11-year-old victims of bullying, it seems like the right time for us all to get a refresher on suicide assessment.
Certainly.
So I want to begin by asking you, what is a thorough way to conduct a face-to-face suicide assessment?
You know, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of different ways to do it. You know, some folks say to do it this way, some folks say to do it that way, and there's really a couple different layers to that question.
Okay.
When you're talking about face-to-face, it kind of depends on at what point of treatment are you looking at this client. You know, there's kind of a triage approach to do it, kind of a quick and dirty way to do it, and there's a more thorough way to do it. I think, unfortunately, many clinicians, they're so pressed for time and they're so stuck in these kind of brief approaches to treatment that they feel like there's really no time for a really thorough, detailed assessment. There's ways to do that, though, but I think a lot of these folks in treatment, a lot of these clinicians are stuck in this really triage approach to assessing suicidal clients. You know, and this is a way a lot of actually hotlines and suicide prevention hotlines will work off of this triage approach. This triage approach really only looks at maybe four or five components of suicide. Usually one of the things that I teach my students in this triage approach is kind of this long-standing model called the PIMP approach, P-I-M-P.
Okay.
Students kind of learn it just because it, you know, has kind of a silly connotation to it or whatever, because it's PIMP, right? But that PIMP stands for plan, intent, means, and then prior attempts.
Okay.
So those four kind of components of do they have a plan, typically the more specific the plan, the greater the lethality of the potential suicidal client. Intent, how much intent do they have or how likely are they to do it? And then means, do they have the means accessible? Are they readily available, whatnot? And then do they have a history of prior attempts? Those kind of four components are really a real basic way to look at and asking clients about those four areas is a real triage approach to it. I don't recommend doing it unless this is just a really rudimentary intake or this is something where, you know, it's a hotline or, you know, it might be a hospital setting, or you really need to kind of set up this kind of who are the most suicidal folks that I'm dealing with here. Only I recommend doing that as kind of a one-time thing. After you see a client after one time, you really want to start establishing a more thorough understanding of their suicidality. So that's kind of where this more thorough approach or more detailed approach to suicide assessment comes in.
And can I ask so a more detailed approach, would that be similar to the assessment tool that's in the back of your book?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Well, it's at a couple different places, and there's a couple of them out there. Kind of the theory behind this is there's been, in terms of counseling, the good news is that, you know, lawsuits against counselors are pretty rare. However, they're on the increase. So one of the things is if you look at this surely as a kind of preventative malpractice kind of issue, and most importantly, a client care issue, the more thorough your assessment, the more likely you'll be able to get a grasp of what this client's suicidality is. So the assessment tool that I developed throughout this book is called the Simple Steps Model. Simple Steps is an acronym, and we can certainly talk about that. But the Simple Steps Model is based off of all the literature that's out there and kind of talk about all these different ways that you can assess suicidal clients in kind of a nice package, if you will. So maybe if I go through that, maybe we could kind of figure out where to go from there.
That would be great.
Yeah. So the Simple Steps model, there's a lot of different acronyms out there.
Mm-hmm.
Most are kind of, like I said, that PIMP model is kind of a triage situation. Mm-hmm. There's two out there, the Simple Steps model, and then there's an acronym by the American Association of Suicidology. They endorse the acronym called ISPATHWARM. Mm-hmm. That's ISPATHWARM.
Mm-hmm.
This ISPATHWARM model. Essentially, both of these are pretty similar. All the components in the ISPATHWARM model is in my model, and most of the components of my model is in that ISPATHWARM model.
Okay.
The key thing to think of is in these longer assessments, how thorough is it?
Mm-hmm.
So if we walk through the Simple Steps model, if you look at the first S in Simple Steps, mm-hmm. it's the key component to any suicide assessment is automatically ask folks, are they suicidal? So the S is suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way to do that, especially because you brought up some suicidal clients who might have been 11 years old,
mm-hmm.
kind of some younger folks. Mm-hmm. Under my care, the youngest client who ever killed themselves was 9 years old. So it's certainly, you know, I think certainly for students and clinicians, mm-hmm. they think that these younger folks are kind of, you know, they have so much to live for. That's really not as accurate as we need to think.
Yeah.
So in that first suicidal question, ask the question, are you suicidal?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that takes a couple different forms. One is when you're working with really, really young kids, really young mm-hmm. children, you might ask that in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a 9-year-old may know what suicidal is,
mm-hmm.
But they may not really, they may say it, but really not know exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually recommend to folks of you have to ask them if they're either suicidal or want to kill themselves.
Okay.
But you kind of progress into that. You might have conversations of, do you know what it is? Do you know what death is like? Has anybody, you know, ever died in your family? Have you ever thought about dying? Kind of start about dying. I avoid going into conversations about hurting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because that has a really different meaning from suicide.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The issue of do you think you might want to hurt yourself might mean, you know, self-mutilation,
mm-hmm.
whatever that might be.
Mm-hmm.
I try to avoid all that conversation, stick just with suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So the first question is, are you suicidal? If they say anything that remotely is in the ballpark of yes,
mm-hmm.
or questioning or him-hawing around the answer,
mm-hmm.
go further in an assessment.
Okay.
So first you look at that suicidal question. The next, the I in simple, is ideation.
Mm-hmm.
And really what we want to assess there is what's the thought process of the suicidal client? What are the thoughts around suicide?
Mm-hmm.
And really what we're looking for there is one is to kind of give you a specific time frame in which this person is thinking of killing themselves, but also see what the thought process is.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, when we think of kind of the thought process of suicidal ideation, one of the things you think of is there's kind of a stage model of how someone progresses from not being suicidal at all
mm-hmm.
to being very suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And those stages, real briefly, one of the things you think of is someone, hopefully, you know, most of our clients are like this, or most of us would be like this, is kind of the lowest level of suicidal ideation, where it's, I'm not suicidal, I don't want to die, I want to live. That's
mm-hmm.
kind of the optimum kind of place that you want to be.
Yes.
The step right above that would be, I don't want to kill myself, but I would want to die.
Mm-hmm.
And you might hear clients say things like, you know, if I got some horrible disease and I were to die tomorrow, that'd be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Or if a bus were to hit me, that'd be okay too.
Mm-hmm.
But when you ask the question, are you thinking about suicide, they say, oh, no, I'm not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's on the path of thinking that you don't want to live anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of a notch above kind of I want to live and I don't
mm-hmm.
want to die.
Mm-hmm.
After that, then you start getting into some suicidal ideation where kind of a moderate level of suicidal ideation would look like, I want to die, I want
mm-hmm.
to kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately the final stage of that suicidal ideation is, I want to die, I want to kill myself, and I know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to kind of ask questions with your client about where they at in that suicidal ideation stage. Have conversations about, do you want to live?
Mm-hmm.
Is essentially what you want to look at. But also in that ideation issue, you want to look at, you want to ask them very specifically of their time frame of suicide. I recommend asking folks on a scale from 1 to 10, 1 being not at all, 10 being definitely, how likely are you to kill yourself within the next 72 hours? That 72-hour mark is important just because a lot of hospitals will adopt that suicidal ideation 72-hour mark to get folks hospitalized.
The 72-hour hold.
Right, to 72-hour hold. Mm-hmm. Or would it be, you know, if somebody comes into our clinic and they say, I can't live within 72 hours, we contact a hospital, we contact the police or whoever we need to contact and say, this person's saying they can't live within 72 hours. Mm-hmm. More than likely, at least here, they'll be able to open up a bed and say, we're going to keep them.
Let me ask you a question about the ideation piece.
Sure.
I think every counselor has been a counselor for a while, has dealt with a client who has for a considerable period of time has said, I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to kill myself, I'm going to kill myself.
Right.
And then they don't kill themselves, and you start not worrying as much about this client. Can you talk a little about that phenomenon?
Yeah. You know, that's a real good question, because I think that has a couple different layers to it. I think one is you talk about these folks who are truly chronically suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of chronically suicidal, these are folks that they'll think about suicide a lot, they'll attempt a lot, but they never go through with it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the folks that, you always kind of have in the back of your mind. You might become a little complacent, but you're never thinking that they're trying to manipulate you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you also have another layer of client that they might be folks that, you know, the drop of the hat, they'll say, I'm going to kill myself to get them something.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing for clinicians to kind of overcome, especially clinicians who've been out there in the field and really in the trenches for a long time. They kind of get familiar with the lingo, and they kind of really get to know these clients and feel that they're manipulating them.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, I think, rudimentary client care, but also for protection against malpractice, that's really a faulty practice.
Mm.
You need to really consider, if they're suicidal, you need to have some consequences of, here's what suicidal means, here's the actions we need to take, and stay consistent with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a four-year-old at home, and I think a lot of things boil down to me of, you know, consistency and practice consistently with child care and everything. And it's kind of one of the issues is, you know, the more consistent you stay with folks who might be manipulating you, the less likely they're going to be manipulating you to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of these issues of burnout or these kind of becoming a little complacent with things, it's really a natural phenomenon, but the more that you're aware of it and the more that you stay consistent with your practice, the better.
Oh, that's a good.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
It does. Okay. So we went from suicide to ideation.
Right.
I'm assuming the next is M.
So the next thing we want to look for is we want to look for the method.
Okay.
And the method is really the means in which they're going to kill themselves.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I don't recommend doing is assessing the true lethality of the means.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you really have specific training in it. I'm not an MD.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a counselor, so I don't know if taking, you know, 8 aspirin will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
My hunch is 8 aspirin, you're not going to have a headache very long.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if a client said, I'm going to kill myself, I've got 8 aspirin, I don't know if they have high blood pressure, if they're taking blood thinner, if they've got all these kind of different things. I treat it as, if you're going to kill yourself, you've got the means at hand, and your client is thinking that, that's going to kill them, then that's going to kill them. It's not my job to assess that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that we want to think of is don't assess the means. Assess, does the client think that the means is going to kill them? Because I've had students and clinicians feel that, you know, this client, they're doing these passive means of suicide by, you know, they're going to take 8 aspirin or, you know, they're going to jump out of the, you know, the second-story window of the house or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what it is as a clinician. If you're saying that's what's going to kill you, I'm going to take you at your word for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, down the road, somebody else can assess those things, but my primary job is to get you help.
Mm-hmm.
So that assessing a means, you also want to say is, are the means available?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in that conversation with folks, you know, if you say, are you going to kill yourself within 72 hours? And they mm-hmm. say, yeah, I'm going to kill myself. How are you going to kill yourself? Well, you know, I might, you know, take 50 Vicodin. Are the Vicodin there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're in the cupboard. Do you have mm-hmm. access to them right now? Yes. So mm-hmm. that would be something pretty serious.
Right.
You know, same thing with a gun. I plan to kill mm-hmm. myself with a gun. Are the bullets there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't have any bullets. Do you know, are you going to get bullets?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of have those conversations about, is the mean available? Are they likely to be there?
Mm-hmm.
And those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so have that conversation. And that's, sometimes that's an awkward conversation, depends on what population you're working with.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you always try to, as a clinician, try to distance those means.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're either talking to somebody in your office or home or whatever that is, you, one of the interventions is you want them to ultimately get rid of the means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're working with Appalachian men and trying to get them to get rid of their gun, that might be a real hard sell.
Right.
But, you know, also at the same time, there's always means available.
Mm-hmm.
Probably everybody's got bleach in their house, everybody's got rope in their house, whatever that might be.
Mm-hmm.
So there, we do as much as we can.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The P in the simple steps, in the simple part,
mm-hmm.
Is kind of a throwback to an old school model called perturbation. This perturbation is really the degree of emotional pain someone's in.
Mm.
Edwin Schneidem, he's been one of the founders of American mm-hmm. Association of Suicidology, and actually mm-hmm. I just got an email, and he unfortunately passed away a couple days ago.
I took a class from him at UCLA.
Did you really?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, Psychological Effects of Suicide, and it was... So many people wanted to take it that
we were
in an auditorium.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's just so unfortunate. He passed away at age 91.
Wow.
So,
and he worked till near the end, I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think he was on the Board of Trustees at the American Association of Suicidology. I mean, he was just such a pioneer. It was such a loss.
It was amazing.
But he was one of the first people to talk about this.
Perturbation.
Perturbation.
Wow.
And this perturbation really is that degree of emotional pain. How much pain are you in?
Mm-hmm.
And really what he talked about is kind of how, not only how much pain are you in, but how much will it take, how much pain does it take for you to kill yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the past, 15, maybe 20 years of research in suicide and suicide assessment, that concept has been lost,
mm-hmm.
but is coming back more and more in the literature now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons I stuck it in, is I think it's really a key element to suicide. And one of the things, I kind of link this at a couple different points in treatment. One is before when we talked about that ideation, I said put it on a 10-point scale of,
mm-hmm.
you know, are you going to kill yourself within 72 hours, how
mm-hmm.
definitely or likely. Some folks say don't use a scaling question with assessing suicidal clients because they might be able to manipulate the numbers to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this perturbation issue kind of counters that, that argument.
Mm-hmm.
Asking the question, you know, referring back to that ideation, you know, you said you were in, you know, if you said you were an 8 on the scale from 1 to 10 of how
mm-hmm.
definitely you were going to be to kill yourself within the last
mm-hmm.
72 hours. The perturbation question is, you said you were an 8. What is it going to take for you to get from an 8 to a 10,
mm-hmm.
and if 10 was suicide?
Mm-hmm.
And you could say that with any number. If they were a 2, you know, or an 8 or whatever they were on that scale,
mm-hmm.
the question, that perturbation question still holds, because what you're assessing there is, you know, if someone says, you know, on a scale from 1 to 10, I'm an 8 on that scale of how likely I'm going to kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's gonna take these horrendous things to happen for me to get from an 8 to a 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my son would have to go off to war. I'd have to get some mm-hmm. disease. I'd have to have all these other things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was working with a client probably a couple months ago, and it was a female client that was pretty chronically suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And she said on this scale from 1 to 10, she was a 3. And I asked her the perturbation question, saying that,
mm-hmm.
You know, what's it going to take for you to get from a 3 to a 10 if 10 was killing yourself? She
mm-hmm.
said, if my husband doesn't put the seat down one more time, I'm going to kill myself. Now, that sounds kind of funny, but at the same time, that kind of shows this person is really spontaneous. If just the one little thing happens, mm-hmm. she could go from suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things, what we've done here is we've looked at really changing this from kind of an ordinal scale to more of an interval scale of how you're looking at things. We could, with this perturbation assessment, we can not only say, how suicidal are they, but what is it going to take for them to get
mm-hmm.
suicidal?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the perturbation question mm-hmm. that you'll look at. So we've done the S is suicidal, the I is ideation, M is method, P is perturbation,
mm-hmm.
and then now we're on the L of simple.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to look at loss here. So the L is loss.
Mm-hmm.
Really what you look for is you want to look for both experienced loss and perceived loss, or actual loss. So one of the things is, and you think a lot about this, like with teenage kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, this loss, I mean, at any age, loss can happen, but you
mm-hmm.
look at, you know, I think I'm going to fail this grade. I think
mm-hmm.
my parents are going to get a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
I think my friend's going to move out of town.
Mm-hmm.
Those are perceived losses compared to actual losses is, you know, I failed my class, I lost this job,
mm-hmm.
my mother passed away. Both are pretty significant, but what sometimes we see is this perceived loss gets built up so much
mm-hmm.
just because there's no closure to it that it could actually be worse than actual loss.
And it could be something like, I think my girlfriend's going to break up with me.
Exactly right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Exactly right. So any of those kind of, I think I'm going to lose something,
mm-hmm.
those conversations is always pretty critical.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to assess both the experienced loss or actual loss or the perceived loss.
Okay.
And we want to look also at not only what those events are, but have a conversation about what the quality of those are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would think that if someone's mother passed away, that's going to be pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
But you might have small, little losses that might equate up to that,
mm-hmm.
up to that big quality loss.
Mm-hmm.
So assessing both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's loss. We're almost done with the simple part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the last part of simple, the E is earlier attempts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, prior attempts, mm-hmm. typically what we think of is the more attempts we've had before, the more likely an actual suicide will be completed.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to assess those. But one of the treatment components of that is really having conversations with clients about what prevented you from killing yourself before or what intervened
mm-hmm.
or whatnot. Because, you know, I've had clients before say, you know, well, you know, my dog came and sat on my lap and I knew if I killed myself, no one would be here to take care of my dog.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, those are good kind of treatment indicators or protective factors to think of what are things in place now in their life that might, based off of what helped them before, what might help them now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that earlier attempts, you can get some good clinical information of what's there.
Okay.
And really one of the new waves of suicide assessment is that protective factor issue. Actually, there's some suicide assessment, paper pencil suicide assessments that are coming out and have come out recently
mm-hmm.
That look less on kind of how suicidal are you. They look more on what are protective factors and how much things keep you alive.
Mm-hmm.
And those are just as important, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So that conversation kind of comes up under that earlier attempts.
Mm-hmm.
So the simple part of the simple steps is done.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we want to look at the steps part. So the first S in steps is substance use.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the big contributing factors of suicide is alcohol, drugs, those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
You look at a couple different things here. One, you look at are they taking any alcohol, drinking, how much are they doing that, any kind of drugs, and what happens as a result of them doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But you also look at questions of are they taking a prescription medication, are they staying med compliant.
Mm-hmm.
And also you want to get in a conversation with your clients and also have a consultation possibly with their psychiatrist or whatnot of kind of how often are psychiatrists kind of monkeying around with their meds and changing things around?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the body feels that things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they're med compliant, their body doesn't know that they're really med compliant on just one drug.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So have those conversations with folks of, you know, are you doing alcohol, drugs? Are you taking prescription medication? Are you staying med compliant?
Mm-hmm.
All those type of issues.
Or is your doctor working with your meds at this time? Changing,
right.
Titrating, whatever.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly right.
Okay.
So that's S in steps.
Mm-hmm.
Next is troubleshooting.
Mm-hmm.
And so the T in steps is troubleshooting.
Mm-hmm.
What we want to look here is, what's the client's problem-solving ability?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of research out there that talks about this in terms of adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
My assumption is that this is true for everybody, but I think the research will focus more of this in terms of adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
What we really want to look at is are you willing to stay alive? And when you think of suicide, what happens before that?
Mm.
What we're looking really at is, you know, when stuff goes wrong, is suicide the first thing that jumps into your mind?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And those kind of troubleshooting, problem-solving kind of things is really an unstable time in clients' lives if suicide is their first thought.
Mm-hmm.
I go out and, you know, I walk out into the hall and I stub my toe, boom, I'm going to think about killing myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
a much more kind of lethal client when they have those thoughts in their mind compared to someone who can kind of flow with things and,
mm-hmm.
and don't think about suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you look at that troubleshooting.
Mm-hmm.
Next part is for the steps is emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Emotion and diagnosis. There's essentially five key emotional factors to working with suicidal clients. The five emotional factors are hopelessness, helplessness, worthlessness, loneliness, and depression. Those five things, hopelessness, helplessness, worthlessness, loneliness, and depression, are the five key emotional factors.
Mm-hmm.
That's beyond diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody doesn't necessarily have to have a diagnosis to be suicidal,
mm-hmm.
but they would have one, if not more, or a combination of those emotions related to suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And then you want to briefly just assess kind of what is the diagnosis of this client.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the new DSM-5 is coming out. We're not exactly sure exactly what that's going to look like, but my thought is a lot of these diagnoses that are already in the DSM-4 TR are going to be ones that kind of are related to suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we think of major depressive episodes, and
mm-hmm.
we think of anxiety and substance abuse and, you know, borderline personality disorder and all
mm-hmm.
these kind of things. So kind of have an idea there of what are some diagnoses associated with suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have two more steps left.
Yeah.
Next is parents
mm-hmm.
Or family history. Typically, when we think of folks that are exposed to suicide,
mm-hmm.
are folks that are more likely to kill themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we think of, is there a family history? Is there a kind of a peer history? What are some things going on in your family? Not only a mental illness, typically some research will say the more maternal depression
mm-hmm.
that a client has, the higher likelihood of suicide they have. So kind of assess those things.
Why not paternal as well?
You know, the research is real sketchy out there.
Yeah.
But what they're looking at is, and it's, you know, some of these stats on suicide is kind of hard to interpret, just because
mm-hmm.
really the only way that these folks assessed, when you're looking at completed suicide,
mm-hmm.
you're getting stuff from family members because this person's dead.
Right.
So
right.
it's kind of hard to really get exactly what this research is.
Right.
But they are somewhat linking at a younger age that the more maternal depression and the more that the client saw that depressiveness come out in mom,
mm.
the more likelihood they'll be suicidal.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I don't know if I want to get into a conversation about, is this a learned behavior, because I don't
yeah.
think it is whatsoever.
Yeah.
But I think mm-hmm. there's at least some interesting research out
mm-hmm.
there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, in the simple steps model, is stress and life events.
Mm.
You know, you can have folks, honestly, that are not suicidal at all,
mm-hmm.
At all, and then stress comes about, and boom, they're suicidal.
Mm.
So assess both how much stress
mm-hmm.
and the quality and how they deal with that stress
mm-hmm.
in there. You know, is there anger issues that arise? And that stress, is there kind of a recklessness in that stress?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
is there kind of, do folks take more chances or mm-hmm. as a result of stress and things like that? So that,
and is it sometimes just a buildup? So there's been a lot of stressors, and there's just one more stressor, and it's not particularly that stressor, but it's just one more stressor, and they couldn't take one more stressor.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's kind of the quantity and quality of those stressors is mm-hmm. is kind of what you want to assess. Now, the conversation took a while, mm-hmm. But when you look at clients, when you're working with clients, that's a way to conceptualize your clients.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly those things, because like I said, you know, kind of on intake, you can do those triage kind of models.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when you talk about a thorough assessment, it's more of a, rather than let's sit down and let's do this conversation, you can do that,
mm-hmm.
but you can also, over two or three or four sessions, you can build a conceptualization of this client based off of the simple steps model
mm-hmm.
that will paint a much richer
mm-hmm.
suicide assessment. For example, you know, when you're assessing somebody for suicide, you know, on session four
mm-hmm.
off the simple steps model, you don't necessarily have to talk about, you know, loss or, you know, what's their diagnosis? You know, you already have those things in place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the key point in this assessment is after you talk with folks about all these areas, then kind of reflect for a couple minutes about how do they stack up on the simple steps model.
Mm-hmm. The simple steps model, I really like it. It's really, it's an excellent model. And I think many of us, we became counselors learning PIMP style models,
right.
meaning the quick triage kind of style, so that you can let the client go at the end of the day, let them go home because
right.
you did that quick
right.
one. But another question that comes up for me as we are looking at this is, what are some differences between assessing suicide in children, adults, older adults, or even families?
You know, still the kind of the format for the simple steps model happens at any age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're working with kids, it's kind of modifying your language to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
I usually recommend, you know, when I'm working with children, I don't use, if you're using scaling questions, for example,
mm-hmm.
I never use a 10-point scale,
mm-hmm.
especially, I mean, if you're working with a 9 or 10-year-old, that
mm-hmm.
10 points is too nebulous on their part. Mm-hmm. I usually say on a scale from 1 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they're, you know, I was working with a 7-year-old, you know, a couple months ago, and I kind of even drew some smiley faces on a sheet, and they say, kind of, this is really happy, and this is really frown face with kind of a tear on it. Where are you at on this kind of smiley face
mm-hmm.
scale? So you kind of modify
That's
it to
great.
Work with kind of what age you're working at.
Mm-hmm.
I think the same thing's true with older adults. When you're working with older adults, there's certainly some things that you want to take into consideration is, I mean, when you think of, you know, you're working with a 75-year-old client, the things that might come up, they might have a lot more loss off of everybody, they have physical concerns come about, they have that existential feeling of death is just around the corner.
Right.
So I think there's different components there based off of what age. That simple steps model kind of goes throughout,
mm-hmm.
but it's really at different points. Kind of modifying your language and also thinking of clients as really unique clients at the different age that they're at.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true for families as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you're working with families, I think a lot of folks would say if you're treating, not necessarily assessing, but if you're treating suicidal clients, you
mm-hmm.
need to have family involved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just really need to have
right.
Kind of what's this team approach
right.
To doing things.
And do you have a point at which you decide to break confidentiality even if the client does not want the family involved?
Well, you do. I'm trying to think about how to articulate that that point.
Yeah.
I don't don't, because typically, I'm trying to think if that's true or not, if I've done that. Usually by the time I bring family in, everybody kind of knows about it.
Okay.
And in, because I think there's a very different thing. The simple steps model is kind of the assessment portion of it.
Right.
And I think assessment is blended into treatment because you have to continually assess. But that treatment component is really a different animal. And that treatment component, because after you assess and after you kind of process this with clients, unless they're really adamant about not having family involved, it's kind of a – if the client does want help but doesn't know how to do it, typically family can be brought in pretty easily. So it's not always kind of a how do we break that confidentiality. It's mostly just – the client will do that themselves.
Yeah,
does
maybe
that make sense?
maybe it's with that shorter triage model. Actually, the PIMP one, where if somebody said, you know, I have a gun at home, I have bullets, and I'm going to go home, that you would want to call their family.
Yeah, and that could happen in a couple different points. One is if someone calls in, like if this is a hotline situation, or you know, I've had clients call me before, you know, after hours, and they say I've got a gun in hand. The only resource I send at that point is the police.
Yes.
I feel uneasy sending any family if there's a gun involved. I don't want them to say I'm killing myself. I've got a gun involved, and then somebody else is getting hurt.
Right.
I said. Right. Police is the only means I send, and that's usually the resource that if somebody, like if it's a really high suicidal lethality and this person is going to kill themselves, they're calling me at home or they're, you know, on my cell phone or if it's a hotline situation or whatever, police is the number one resource just to make sure they're going to get there a lot quicker. Then if somebody gets hurt, I don't want any of that kind of stuff to happen.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, but if someone's, you know, if someone's not highly suicidal and they're in your office, police aren't necessarily the option you want to do. You'd have conversations with your client about kind of what would it look like if we brought, you know, mom in, or if we brought, you know, your sister in or something like that. Have those conversations. Because one of the things is as a clinician, you do want to kind of – I don't know how to say this in an appropriate way, kind of assess the client's family for appropriateness. For example, you know, Cousin Billy is wonderful to talk to, but he's the one that's causing all the problems. Cousin Billy might not be the person you want in this intervention. So it's kind of looking at kind of what, who are the players in this family, who would be helpful, who might or might not exacerbate the situation. kind of have those discussions, kind of have that feel.
That's a good point. As we move more towards treatment in this conversation, what are some issues of treatment planning with suicide clients?
Yeah. You know, the big thing when we talk about the treatment planning issue, there's a couple things.
Okay.
One is you want to talk about when you do those goal settings with clients, goal setting is such a critical part of treatment, not only in treatment planning, but in actual client treatment for suicidal folks. Just because typically folks that are suicidal, one, they probably feel out of control in life. Providing them with specific tasks or goals to accomplish gives them some control of their life, but you got to make sure those goals are pretty attainable. I mean, it could be tomorrow I want you to get out of bed and, you know, fix yourself some cereal, and that's the only thing I want you to accomplish tomorrow. I mean, it could be just real fundamental kind of sustaining life stuff. But if they see that on paper or if they see that and they know they're accomplishing those goals, it does give them kind of control of their life. So, but it also shows in terms of your progress with clients over a long term of kind of how much progress they've made. So that goal setting, not only important to the client, but important to you in terms of the clinician, in terms of how are you treating this person. So the goal setting is important. Other component that's real important in treatment planning is setting up what I call a resource tree. Mm-hmm. And this resource tree, one of the things, and this is not only for client care, but this is also kind of protective against malpractice issues.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that folks that have gotten malpractice suits against them in suicide cases, one of the things that hurt those clinicians was they didn't do appropriate follow-up care, and they mm-hmm. didn't provide clients with good enough resources that are, A, appropriate, but B, very doable.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I talk about not only in my book, but I teach my students is how to set up what this resource tree is, you know, one, you want to have conversation with your clients of can they identify and when do they identify when they're first starting to feel suicidal?
Mm-hmm.
This is not only for chronically suicidal folks, but this might be client comes to you and said, I've never thought about suicide before, but mm-hmm. I'm thinking about it now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have conversations with your clients about, you know, when do you feel suicidal? When are the times that you might feel more suicidal, or when do you feel it coming on?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of when do you feel the symptoms of this cold kind of happening?
Mm-hmm.
Have conversations, and typically folks will be able to recognize those.
Mm-hmm.
This resource tree comes in where you, as soon as you identify, the client identifies when they're suicidal, establish a kind of a prioritized list, and I always write this out for the client, put it in treatment plan, but what I also do is I put this resource tree, I copy it on paper, and I make a little card out of it and laminate and stick it in their wallet.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll always have it. So I'll have conversations with them of, you know, if you're thinking about killing yourself without calling anybody, what is one thing that you can do to help you out right now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it journaling or exercising or listen to music?
Mm-hmm.
Have them pick the one thing that they think will work.
Mm-hmm.
And then say, well, if that can't work or doesn't work, what's the next thing?
Mm-hmm.
And then so you want to go – so the first part of this resource tree is – what's the first thing you could do without calling anybody, and go through four or five different things that they can do to try to alleviate this suicidal thought.
Mm-hmm.
If none of those four or five things work, who's the first person you're going to call?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And on this card that I make them, it'll have their name and their phone number.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be people, it could be agencies, it could be whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A hotline, mm-hmm. whatever it is. So usually the components that I have on that, and I create five things for them to do. Who's the first person you're mm-hmm. going to call? And again, kind of have conversations about the appropriateness of that contact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, I don't know if anybody actually has a cousin Billy, but I'm picking on cousin Billy today. You know, somebody does, I'm sure. So I apologize to cousin Billy. But you know, if this is the person that's causing trouble or, mm-hmm. or might not be appropriate in this situation,
mm-hmm.
don't put that person on the list.
Right.
Not saying that they're not a great person; it's just not time to involve them at this
point.
Not
at that time. Yeah.
And then go through five folks, and I always have a hotline on there. There's a lot of mm-hmm. local hotlines. There's a lot of national hotlines.
Mm-hmm.
I have myself on this number, on mm-hmm. this list. And then always the last contact, I'll say 911.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So having that resource is really just a critical part of follow-up care in terms of clients.
And how excellent that you laminate it and put it on a card for their wallet. I mean, that's different, and I like that a lot.
Yeah, it feels like they have something tangible.
Now, I think that, I think that, first of all, I think everybody should read your book, because I've read three books on suicide recently, and it is by far my favorite.
Well, thank you.
Not because I love the subject, period, but because it is so thorough. Your book is very thorough. But let me ask you a question that we get here sometimes from our members, and that is for the clinician who has worked really hard and who has really done all the right things, and the client commits suicide.
Yeah.
That clinician, do you have any thoughts, anything you can say for that clinician?
Yeah, boy, you know, I mean, as somebody that's gone through it mm-hmm. before myself,
mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of work at agencies consulting out, you know, helping folks in these situations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the counselor mode breaks in right away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it absolutely is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
What you want to do is, I think you want to if you're working with somebody like this, if you're working with another clinician, I think the big thing is empathy.
Mm.
Listen to their story. Mm-hmm. Don't automatically go into the scrutinized mode of documentation and what
mm-hmm.
did you do.
Mm-hmm.
I think letting the person talk this out, vent it out, is the key thing. Now, a lot of times agencies will automatically go into how are we going to protect ourselves?
Exactly.
Did you screw up? And that's really, I see where that comes in, and that's more than likely going to happen
yeah.
and is necessary to happen,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't have to be the first move that's made.
Right.
So I think the first step would be the empathy thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also hearing the clinician's story about what progressed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think the things that help clinicians, you know, we're in such a culture now where it's third-party payer-driven and,
mm-hmm.
and all these kind of things, it boils down to how do you document.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say, you know, off the simple steps model in terms of treatment planning, document all those type of things.
Right.
It takes a little bit more time, but the more you can kind of do it, the better.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a very good point. Yeah. Well, our time is coming to a close, but I did want to ask you, why do you study suicide?
You know, it started when I was an undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Otterbein College, a small little school in Westerville, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what I was going to be when I first started college.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my uncle was a mathematician, so I started out in math, and I said, oh, this isn't for me. But I came across a couple psych classes, and
mm-hmm.
one of the assignments was you need to go out and volunteer somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I volunteered at Suicide Prevention Services in Franklin County
mm-hmm.
In Columbus, Ohio. And ever since then, I think it's a population that I really gravitated towards
mm-hmm.
because they're at such a point in their life where it's so, you know, unstable, it's so tremendously, you know, impactful in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It just got to a point where I just felt like that is a niche of clients that
yeah.
I feel comfortable working with, but I think I could lend some help to.
Well, I want to thank you, Jason McLaughlin, for talking to us about suicide assessment and treatment, and I want to encourage all of our members to look at Dr. Jason McLaughlin's book. I think you will be very pleased with what you see there.
Well, thank you. You know, there's a lot of books of suicide out there. However,
yes.
The one thing is I mean, I hope my students would say this, is I'm not a big fan of dry material.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of my book is pretty basic. It's simply written, and it's
mm-hmm.
a clinician's kind of thing.
It's juicy.
It's
juicy.
Well,
it's not dry.
Well, but I, far too many books that I read, and I think my students will probably read as well, is
mm-hmm.
you know, it's dry theory work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm just a clinician at heart. So
yeah, thank
yeah.
goodness.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us today. To view links to this program or to write to the presenter or the host, go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the ACA 2009 podcast series, signing off.